Morning, folks. We can get started and let a few other people trickle in as people buckle down for the snowstorm of the century, apparently. My name's Alex Lennon. I'm the editor of the Washington Quarterly here at CSIS. I wanted to welcome you for the session. We're delighted to have this accompanying the release of the new issue of the January issue of the January 2010 issue of the Washington Quarterly. And the feature section of about half the issue is on Iran and what to do going forward. We're delighted to have two of the authors that are based in D.C. for the piece, Ambassador Jim Dobbins to my left and Suzanne Maloney immediately to his. And we've also asked Andy Cutchins, who's the Russia director at CSIS, to give a perspective on what Russia might do going forward after the two authors give a presentation on their piece. The session, as we lay it out, is a bit different than how we normally do these sessions because of the holidays. Basically, we've got to clear out of here by 1:30 to allow for the entire conference rooms to be set up for the holiday party for CSIS at the end of this. So we're going to do the discussion before lunch, and then at about 12:30 or so, the atrium will be open up for people to serve themselves, and we can continue a more informal discussion. This is not meant to be a presentation or a lecture to have you hear just the speakers, but to have them give presentations to kick off a discussion around the table, which will continue until about 12:30 or so. As you can tell by the titles of the two speakers' pieces that were announced in the invitation that was sent around, Ambassador Dobbins wrote a piece on negotiations and Suzanne Maloney on her work on sanctions. These are not meant as alternatives for what to do with Iran going forward, but to look at in-depth into what those two avenues of work with Iran might yield on the Iranian nuclear issue, both in the past few months and as we go into the new year, with an expectation that the sanctions track will be accelerated in the coming weeks and months. Ambassador Dobbins, of course, is the director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND and was a special envoy for Afghanistan, one of the few American officials who's had experience actually negotiating with officials from Tehran. And Suzanne, former policy planning analyst, has done work for a long period of time on Iran in general and specifically on the sanctions options. So with that, I'm going to ask each of them to begin talking for about 5 to 7 minutes or so, give initial remarks just to kick off a discussion. Then I'll ask Andy just to give his perspective on what the Russian view of the current situation is and what they might do in the coming weeks and months. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ambassador Dobbins.
Thanks. Well, my piece in the magazine was really a set of reflections on my own experience with the Iranians back in 2001 and 2002, and it's a series of anecdotes illustrating how helpful the Iranians were in the aftermath of 9/11 in assisting the United States in composing a successor government to the Taliban and installing that government and promoting a consensus among the various factions of the opposition to the Taliban on the nature and personalities in that government, a government which has since been legitimized through various constitutional processes, but remains largely the same under Hamid Karzai. Americans are so unused to dealing with Iran. It's been so long since we had normal and indeed even abnormal relations with the Iranians that there's a certain sense that this is a particularly esoteric art. And that dealing with Iran is particularly arcane. That certainly wasn't my experience. I came to the negotiations with the Iranians in the aftermath of 9/11 after having spent many years dealing with Soviet apparatchiks and then Caribbean dictators, Somali warlords, Balkan war criminals, and Afghan mujahideen. And among this group, I found the Iranians by far the most professional, the most reliable, and the most cooperative. So I did not find this a particularly esoteric experience. Now, it's true that the Iranian government that I was dealing with, or whose representatives I was dealing with, was a different one than the one we face today. And I'm not suggesting that the experience of Bill Burns and others who are trying to deal with them is identical. But the Iranians have and can field very professional diplomats who can who can operate at a quite sophisticated level. I do think, in terms of how we view our the prospects for relations with Iran and dealing with Iran, the topic of today's conference, can the Iranian nuclear program be stopped? Is that the right
Close enough.
Yeah, is a bit the problem. In other words, we focused almost exclusively on this particular aspect of Iranian behavior, to the exclusion of many other potential objectives and interests, in a way that I think skews our consideration and our policy probably in unhelpful ways. It does seem to me that there are three basic objectives in dealing with Iran, one of which is to halt or reverse the Iranian nuclear program. But a second one is to moderate Iranian external behavior more generally. And a third is to moderate the nature of the Iranian regime and move it toward a more open, more democratic system of government. Now, those three objectives are to some degree synchronous and synergistic in the sense that if you achieve any one of them, you either help achieve the others or at least make not achieving the others less problematic. So if you had a moderate, responsible Iranian regime, people would be less concerned about its gaining access to nuclear technology. If you had a democratic and open Iranian regime, you'd probably have more moderate policies, and again, people would be less concerned about its nuclear aspirations. And of course, if you were able to curb its nuclear aspirations, it would be easier to live with the regime as it exists and its policies otherwise as they exist. So these three objectives are convergent, but they're also to some degree in tension with each other, because the things you would do to maximize one of them may actually make another one more difficult. So, for instance, and I think the best example of this is in the area of sanctions. To the extent you feel that you need to take a punitive approach with respect to sanctions, and a broadly punitive approach, you're probably making operating counter to your other two objectives. That is, that you're probably neither promoting moderate policies generally on the part of Iran, nor are you assisting those forces within the country that are seeking a more democratic and more open regime. And I think there are many other examples where emphasis on a single one of these tends to operate against the others. This is not unusual in foreign affairs and international relations. It's in fact quite usual, and policy always is an effort to balance a set of competing priorities, and that's the case here. But certainly, in terms of the public debate, the nuclear priority has for years taken such an overwhelming priority that the others tend to be lost, which is particularly surprising in current circumstances when the prospects of a political evolution within Iran, although by no means bright, are at least more real and more more evident than they have been in a long time. And yet that doesn't seem to be the principal focus of American policy or others. The emphasis on Iran's nuclear program is natural enough. First of all, there are time deadlines and time pressures, rather, that don't necessarily apply in the other spheres. We've lived with Iran as it is for 30-some years, and so it's not as if these other considerations are quite as pressing. We haven't lived with a nuclear Iran, and so that would be something new and different. And this is particularly the case, of course, from the Israeli perspective. I think the difference between the Israeli perspective and the American perspective, to the extent there is one, is that the United States has gotten used to living with adversaries who have nuclear weapons. We've done it for 60 years. The Israelis have had a nuclear monopoly in the region, and they'd like to preserve it. They're not used to living with adversaries who have nuclear weapons. They've never had the experience. And they'd prefer, naturally enough, not to have to learn how to live with adversaries who have nuclear weapons if they can avoid it. And so there is a certain difference between the two perspectives, but there's a sense of time urgency in either case. My personal view is that we need to try to develop a strategy toward Iran that gives adequate attention to all three of those objectives. And is a strategy that is sustainable over an extended period of time and is sustainable, indeed, if the Iranians cross the nuclear threshold. It doesn't mean you give up the objective of denuclearizing Iran, and you need a strategy that takes you across that threshold and which is nevertheless sustainable and which offers the prospect of achieving all three of those objectives, of denuclearizing Iran, moderating its external behavior, and changing the nature of its regime. Those are all legitimate objectives, and we ought to have a strategy that pursues all of them, recognizing the tensions between them. Finally, I'll just say a word about sanctions, because Susan and I, she's heard this all, of course, several times, but she and I testified up on the Hill on Tuesday on the subject, along with a couple of others. And I think that the general view is that sanctions at this stage are inevitable. The Iranian regime is probably incapable of engaging substantively and effectively with the international community, even though significant elements of its leadership are quite prepared and would like to see a deal which would put off any denouement in that confrontation for several years. But it looks like it's not going to happen because of the internal weakness, confusion, tensions, and that therefore the U.S. and the rest of the international community are going to move toward sanctions. Just conclude by saying that, first of all, I don't think, and I think it was the consensus of all four of the witnesses, Republican as well as Democratic witnesses, that sanctions are probably not going to influence Iranian nuclear policy. Nevertheless, I supported a strengthened sanctions regime because I think there are at least five reasons why it makes sense to consider further sanctions against Iran. One is, of course, to influence their behavior, their nuclear policy. A second potential objective of sanctions is to influence the evolution, the internal evolution, and the nature of the regime. A third is to actually weaken the capacity of the regime, both to pursue a nuclear program and more substantially to pursue military and other forms of power projection. And then another objective, of course, is to moderate Iranian behavior more generally. Another objective is, and perhaps the most important objective, in my view, is to by example deter others from going down the same route. Were the international community to tolerate Iran's nuclear program, it would be giving a green light to others in the region and maybe beyond to go down the same route. And therefore, isolating Iran, making it a pariah, And retaining that, even if it crosses the nuclear threshold, is very important, even if the sanctions have absolutely no effect on Iran, or and even, indeed, if they're if they have a negative effect, given the importance of not sending a signal which would encourage others to go down. And the final reason, however, why to consider sanctions is the most decisive one, and that is the don't just stand there, do something reason. Sanctions offer, in many cases, and in this case, the only alternative between two even less palatable options, one of which is to do nothing, and the other is to go to war. Sanctions are a very attractive alternative, an irresistibly attractive alternative. In fact, I think that many of the members we were testifying in front of seemed implicitly to be acknowledging that while the sanctions package on which they were about to vote was not ideal and had elements to it that could be quite counterproductive, nevertheless, it was the only package they were offered, and they had to do something, and were going to vote for it. And I think that's pretty much the attitude of many as they regard sanctions. Nevertheless, I do believe that the sanctions package that the House did vote on had a number of quite seriously negative elements in terms of its likely effect on the Iranian internal debate. And given that it had no prospect of affecting their policy, or virtually no prospect of affecting their policy, accepting those negative consequences was, in my judgment, unnecessary, and a package of sanctions that were more targeted on the regime and less targeted on the population as a whole would have made better sense. I'll stop there.
Great, thanks. Let me turn it over to Suzanne, and then I want to ask a couple of questions about the speakers before sort of broadening it to the international dimension, which I'll have Andy kick off.
Oh, I wasn't sure if you were posing your questions first
Thank
you.
I'll let you speak first.
good, that way I don't have to think too quickly. thank you, Alex, and thank you to the Washington Quarterly for printing our material and giving us this opportunity to have a conversation with you today on the issue of Iran policy. Obviously, we're just days away from the end of the year, which has been long understood to be the informal but rather frequently articulated deadline for the administration's policy of seeking to engage the Islamic Republic in a serious way. And yet, for some time, I would say, really, since the June 12th elections and the turmoil that erupted after it, I think it's been widely understood that engagement probably wasn't going to bring us where we needed to be with the Iranians. And so at this point, there's already been a lot of conversation, both in the public sphere and, I suspect, a lot of planning behind closed doors in various halls of government for the next stage of U.S. policy and international policy toward Iran, which is understood to be one that is going to focus on punitive measures or sanctions. As Ambassador Dobbins suggested, we were testifying. We did a sort of warm-up act for this conversation earlier in the week before a House subcommittee, where we had the extraordinary experience of having one of these really, I think, amenable conversations and enlightened conversations. It wasn't a combative political discussion of sanctions, but one in which there seemed to be genuinely probing interest on the part of a number of representatives in the utility of particularly the Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act that they were about to vote on, and generally about how they could best influence Iranian behavior. And yet, as one acknowledged even in the question and answer period, they were all likely to go and vote for the very piece of legislation that they had just heard a lot of criticism of. And in fact, most of them probably did, because I believe that it passed the House overwhelmingly with perhaps 12 votes against. And I don't know if any of those that were present at the hearing on Tuesday were among those 12. But I think this gets to one of the essential and really perennial dilemmas of U.S. policy toward Iran, is that we're constantly striving for some new way to influence the calculus of a government that we frankly never fully understand sufficiently, and I include me and everyone in this room in that group. And have failed over 30 years to influence in the way that we'd like to. We have been engaged with Iran since the earliest days of the revolution, both in terms of incentives and counter-incentives, and yet we have failed to either reverse the persistent pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, as well as the other areas of consistent concern by the American government, which include, of course, support for terrorism, opposition to the peace process, and, as is now newly relevant again after June, treatment of the Iranian citizenry. And so there's almost been a cyclical approach to U.S. policy toward Iran, various highs and lows of efforts to engage that have led to both high comedy, one can point to the Iran-Contra affair, as well as tragedy, and to the frustration of the past year in which the Obama administration has sought both publicly and from what we know from the press reports as well privately to bring the Iranians to the table in a serious and positive way. There was at least a moment, particularly during the editing phase of these articles, when it appeared that the administration might have had some marginal success against all odds. And that was, of course, the October 1st preliminary agreement in Geneva that the Iranians would accept a proposal to ship out somewhere in the range of two-thirds of their produced low-enriched uranium as part of a deal to provide more highly enriched uranium for a medical research reactor. That deal subsequently fell apart, and I think added to the general frustration with the idea of engagement, added to the sense that this is a regime which is not capable of coming to the table in a serious way, and I think created additional momentum for the idea of sanctions that had already had been seriously strengthened in the aftermath of the June violence, the crackdown, the repression, and the evidence that this was an Iranian leadership which was no longer incorporating the views of its more moderate elements and one whose own commitments to its people were not being respected. And so, therefore, the very sense of engagement in negotiations as a credible way to deal with the increasingly urgent nature of the nuclear program was undermined by those developments. So the combination of those, I think, two forces over the past year, the crisis in June and the subsequent violence, which steeled the resolve of many of our European partners, and then the disastrous handling by the Iranians of what was at least briefly a promising preliminary deal on their nuclear issue earlier this fall, has led, I think, to almost a complete frustration with the idea of engagement. You've heard the amped-up rhetoric from various administration officials. We will be engaging in crippling sanctions that are intended to strike at the Achilles heel of the Iranian regime. I am not an opponent of sanctions. Let me put that on the record at the outset. What I find problematic about the current debate, and particularly about the way that the administration is posturing some of the rhetoric, is that it presents sanctions as an alternative to diplomacy and engagement. And we know, frankly, that the track record of sanctions is quite modest. We can get into that a little bit, and the article does try to do some of this. But we recognize from history that sanctions haven't succeeded in mitigating our concerns about Iranian behavior. And to the extent that that a focus on sanctions suggests that diplomacy has no part in our current policy, when and if sanctions fail, as they're likely to do, in changing or fully reversing Iran's nuclear calculus, we will be left with even more unpalatable options on the table, which is to say regime change externally imposed, something that we are wholly incapable of doing, but certainly not incapable of trying and botching disastrously, or some sort of military strike on the Iranian nuclear program or more broadly on the regime. And both of those, I think, would have disastrous implications for our interests in the region. And it's why I think it's very important as we embark on a sanctions mission to think about the track record, to consider what the options are, to work to avoid some of the pitfalls that have limited the utility of sanctions in the past, and to be clear that sanctions are a part of a diplomatic strategy to bring Iran to the table to deal seriously on its nuclear program rather than positing them as some sort of alternative, because that sort of a posture is not a cost-free one. Let me just speak a little bit about why it is there's so much optimism today about sanctions, because I think that's fueling some of the problematic rhetoric that we're hearing. Obviously, as I said, it's related to changes in the internal politics of Iran. There is a sense today that the regime is far weaker than it has ever been, at least since the earliest years of the revolution, that the elites are divided. that there is a new alienation among the population, and I think all these senses are quite correct. I can't say that we know how sanctions would impact that situation, however, but there are certainly those who suggest that the divisions, the unrest, the dissatisfaction within Iran today would mean that new economic pressure could force the regime to bend in ways that it hasn't in the past, precisely because its ultimate objective is regime security. And so a regime that is feeling threatened from within will be more susceptible to economic pressure from without at this stage. The other piece, I think, that is fueling some of the interest and new optimism about sanctions today is the economic vulnerabilities of Iran. Oil prices are not at their all-time low, but they are certainly far lower than they were only a year and a half ago, somewhere around half the record price of $147 a barrel. And that is right about at the point of pain for the Iranian regime, because what has sustained Ahmadinejad and whatever internal support that he has, what has enabled the regime to continue to both repress and co-opt its population, has been an epic spending program over the past 5 years. And so oil prices that are even at a reasonably high rate of $70 or $80 a barrel are still within range of current Iranian spending and put the regime under additional pressure. The fact that the spending has created enormous inflation has added to the perennial problem of unemployment and has really hit at the pocketbooks of the Iranian people, again, plays into the sense that economic pressure can work particularly well at this stage. Finally, I think there's a lot of optimism about sanctions simply because there's been such a change in the international context, both as a result of Iran's internal problems, but particularly because of the Obama administration's diplomacy, the reset of the relationship with Russia, the new honeymoon that the administration has in its relationships abroad, that has at least apparently produced a little bit more traction for the idea of economic pressure. So I think it's not without reason that there is a sense today that sanctions can have some impact on Iran. But I think all of that is undercut by a series of problems that we can see from the track record. One is that historically we've been dealing with unilateral sanctions and a unilateral approach to pressure Iran economically. As I suggested, that may be changing, but I think we don't yet have the evidence that even those countries, European countries in particular, who've been very tough on Iran in their rhetoric, are yet prepared to absolutely jeopardize their economic relationships with Iran. The same, of course, is true for Russia and China. And the difficulties, of course, of getting and maintaining an international coalition on multilateral sanctions are twofold. One is that it's a zero-sum kind of an approach. So long as the Russians think the Chinese might defect, so long as the Germans don't expect the Russians to come to the table in a serious way, there's no incentive for any of them to sign on, because the sense is that business loss to their own companies will only be gained to other international firms. And so we need to get as wide a coalition as possible, and that's a very difficult thing to do, even for an administration that has had some success in repairing U.S. relations with some of our critical allies. The other problem with maintaining an international coalition on sanctions is simply that there is a kind of diametrically opposed logic that the rest of the world has when it comes to sanctioning Iran compared with the American perspective. The traditional perspective here in Washington is that economic pressure will force the regime to moderate because its interest is in its own survival. I would say that most of our allies outside of Europe believe just the opposite, that economic pressure will radicalize the Iranian regime, will further isolate it, will, in fact, quite possibly prompt retaliatory measures against supporters of sanctions or retaliatory measures in the form of some sort of withdrawal from the NPT and or acceleration of the nuclear program. This underlying logic, I think, persists, even though we've been able to improve our relationships with Russia and China, and I think it will continue to plague us as we try to bring some of our allies on board when it comes to sanctions. The irony is, of course, that neither the American presumption that pressure leads to moderation nor the international assumption that pressure will lead to radicalization has proven true in the past. And that's where looking at the track record of sanctions is quite useful. In fact, if you look back at Iranian history, there have been a various series of ways that the regime has responded to economic pressure. Most notably, as we've heard even this week, with defiance. The regime simply says, this doesn't affect us. We can live, as Ahmadinejad has said, with $5 a barrel oil. We can live without any trade with the rest of the world. And indeed, this was the approach that the regime took in the earliest years after the revolution. And there's a certain degree, I think, of both national pride and revolutionary elan associated with that period that is particularly appealing to the people around Ahmadinejad. The sense of self-sufficiency that prevailed as a result of necessity during the earliest phases of the Iran-Iraq War is particularly attractive to those who see that as the kind of formative experience and the crucial experience for the revolution. In reality, of course, very early on, Tehran realized that it had to find ways to get around the sanctions, to mitigate their impact, both through nurturing of infant industries at home, activating smuggling networks, and engaging in other sorts of activities, previously mentioned Iran-Contra, to substitute for the products that it wasn't able to get as a result of various sanctions and embargoes. And Iran has continued with all of these sorts of policies and measures, even to this day, particularly with respect to the talk about a ban on imports of refined petroleum products. Iran has been engaged since over several years in a gasoline rationing program, in various measures to deal with domestic demand for gasoline that include substitution of compressed natural gas on most public vehicles, as well as some strategic stockpiling and enhanced activation of smuggling networks, specifically to deal with what they recognized was a vulnerability, just as it became an idea that many here in Washington latched upon as the quote-unquote Achilles heel of the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime was, of course, working very hard to eliminate that vulnerability. The other long-term effort that they've been engaged in has been to expand and upgrade their refinery capacity so that over the span of the next 2 years, that vulnerability will shrink in large degree. So I think it's important to recognize that whatever we expect the impact of some of our sanctions to be economically, it may not be as significant precisely because the Iranians are well-schooled in deflecting and mitigating the impact of those sanctions. More broadly, I'd say that Iran has experienced a number of periods of severe economic pressure in the past, whether it was the aftermath of the revolution, the period of the war, various points at which the oil price dropped precipitously in the 80s, again in the late 1990s. And never has this corresponded to a sustained moderation of Iranian foreign policy. What the regime has typically done under periods of economic pressure has been to bring its house together, to come together, bring the factions together, and agree often on austerity measures, often on hard, argued economic policy changes. But the only evidence that economic pressure has, in fact, moderated foreign policy has been to the extent it contributed to the development of the reform movement, who did appreciate that Iran's economic perspectives and its potential for obtaining foreign investment and growing the economy was related to its foreign policy and its behavior, its interactions and relationships with the world. That appreciation, that sort of a connection, is not one that Ahmadinejad and, frankly, the conservatives more broadly have ever acknowledged or, in fact, suggested in their behavior that they respect. They believe, in fact, in the China model, that Iran can grow economically even as it engages in repression at home, even as it engages in questionable and troublemaking behavior in the region. And so I think at this stage, given that these are the people who clearly have the upper hand in Iran, it's fallacious to assume that there's going to be some sort of quick reversal of Iran's nuclear policy as a result of even sustained and severe economic pressure. What we don't know is the impact on the opposition movement. I think that is a critical uncertainty in the way that we approach sanctions. So the point of the article, the point of the discussion, and I hope we will engage more deeply here and around Washington, in looking forward to a sanctions policy that is not perceived or represented as an alternative to diplomacy, nor as a sort of saving grace for dealing with the longstanding issues of Iran. Sanctions require a couple of ingredients that are very difficult to obtain, both protracted duration and widespread implementation. And so if we're going to be using sanctions, we have to recognize both the likelihood of their success and the difficulties of implementing them. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Suzanne. As I mentioned before, let me ask sort of two questions to you two before expanding the discussion on the more international basis and keep this at the bilateral level. When you start to go down the sanctions road, the way at least that I was sort of framing as we're putting through the discussion in the articles is you begin to think about who would impose the sanctions, when would they be imposed, and what sanctions would you impose as you put together a package early in the year. The when seems to be fairly obvious as we're working toward. The who is going to be UN Security Council first and see what comes out of it. But on the what sanctions are imposed, there seems, has been at least, a clearly divergent logic between the sanctions that are being formulated on the Hill in the United States and the international sanctions. On the Hill, the idea of crippling sanctions seems to have targeted things like refined petroleum products and insurance and reinsurance that would affect current Iranian trade, whereas the international dimension, not just the Russians and the Chinese, but the European allies as well, very vocally, in fact, the French Foreign Minister Kouchner and others have said, don't target sanctions at the Iranian people, whereas the Hill's conception of crippling sanctions seems to be targeted at the Iranian people. Is that merging? Is there a sense that the politics of what sanctions you impose are changing on the Hill to get away from sanctions targeted at current economic trade that would affect the Iranian people? Let Suzanne take the first crack at that.
I think there's been a lot of talk about sanctions for quite some time, and IRPSA, the idea of addressing this kind of heretofore untapped vulnerability within Iran was politically quite, I think, golden up until June. June changed that. June changed the politics for anyone sitting on the Hill because it's one can still contest how much influence the Iranian people may or may not have over the regime's nuclear policy. Obviously, it's indirect in any extent. But it is now, I think, politically problematic for the U.S. Congress, both for individual congressmen and from the perspective of what this country stands for internationally, to be engaged in sort of actions that would be cutting home heating oil for Iranians in the middle of the winter. I don't think that would have been as politically sensitive had the events of June not occurred for people here on the Hill. And so I would say that we were hearing from various representatives who were saying, you know, we want to be doing something, and this is all we've got in front of us. We recognize that it's imperfect, and if you can show us some other way to help the Iranian people, we'd be happy to do it. I would also say that even those, some of the sponsors of IRPSA, the Iran Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act, initially envisioned it as a kind of Plan C. Plan A was engagement. Plan B was intended to be multilateral sanctions at the UN Security Council. And this was supposed to be something that would move, would be acted upon if and when those other routes appeared to run aground. For reasons that I don't fully understand, the House decided to push forward its consideration of IRPSA back in October after the revelations of the previously secret enrichment facility at Nir Qom in Iran, to make a statement about displeasure with Iranian cooperation and unwillingness to negotiate. I don't know to what extent there is an understanding or a willingness to decelerate the process of pushing on this front in order to give multilateral sanctions some room to maneuver. In part because if IRPSA, as it is was originally conceived, were to be implemented, it could engage us in sanctioning Chinese companies because it is China that's been engaged with helping Iran upgrade its refinery capacity. So I don't think that's a fight we want to be picking right now while we're trying to bring the Chinese around at the Security Council. And I would hope that that sort of an argument is persuasive to people on the Hill.
I didn't have the feeling that the congressmen who were going to vote for this bill thought it likely that the bill would emerge from the Senate unchanged and go to the president in anything like its current form. And in fact, the chairman said that he had indicated he was not going to vote for the bill unless he had assurance from the bill sponsors that it would either contain an adequate waiver provision, which would allow the president to waive its application, or that it would be held in the Congress until the White House signaled they were ready for it. Mm-hmm. So I think we're still a long way from congressional action on this, and I think the Congress is going to wait and see what kind of multilateral package the president can put together.
The second quick question is, there was an editorial in the New York Times today that Roger Cohen wrote called The Inertia Option. I may be reading too much into the two remarks. What's that?
I didn't see that.
Yeah. Maybe I'll let Suzanne talk first and you can take a look at it.
Yeah, okay.
The question, or if I can read a little bit into your remarks, I would... You actually, Ambassador Dobbin, sort of laid out five arguments why you would not favor this option, at least in the long run. I don't know about the near term. One of which seems to be sort of the overwhelming, compelling argument driving the sanctions process, which is regardless of what happens in Iran itself, there is a regime that needs to be defended more broadly, and there can't be consequences for countries flouting the international commitments they make through the IAEA and others. Suzanne, if I'm reading too much into your comments, let the group know, but it sounds like you are leaning in the other direction, that the inertia option makes a lot of sense to you for some period of time going forward. I think some would say we've been in sort of a three-month inertia period, or at least 2 months, since it was pretty clear that the research reactor proposal was not going to be accepted by the Iranian government for whatever means, whether it was because it was incapable or unwilling to make that agreement. But Suzanne, let me start with you and give Jim a chance to keep skimming. Would you at this point favor the inertia option for some period of time, rather than going forward with the predetermined sanctions timeline that was set up prior to the Iranian election?
I wouldn't favor inertia because I think one of the difficulties with our policy toward Iran is that it tends to be too often reactive rather than proactive. And here's a case where the administration has made some statements about where it's going next, and if we don't go there, that raises questions about political will and ability to formulate a coherent policy. But I do think that the broader point that Roger Cohen makes is a very good one, that often when it comes to Iran, doing nothing and saying nothing is better than trying to be overly activist. I would say that I think what we need to be doing is formulating a sanctions approach which does not obviate, either rhetorically or in the actual implementation of new punitive measures, the ability to come to the table and the willingness to come to the table by the international community if and when we can get the Iranians there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Cohen is sort of adopting the opposite slogan that I put forward, which was, you know, I argued that don't just stand there, do something was the most compelling incentive behind the next round of sanctions, and he's arguing that don't just do something, stand there. And I guess, you know, my sense is that the timing of sanctions is going to be governed not by what the Congress or even the president wants, but what he can get. And you're probably going to have sustained pressure if you want sanctions 3 or 4 months from now. So doing nothing would postpone that, you know, even further. And I don't think, you know, a prolonged inactivity on the part of the international community is really politically sustainable here or probably elsewhere for the reasons that I've cited. But I quite agree that there's no rush and that the administration doesn't appear to be rushing. It's just trying to exert a constant pressure on the system to move it forward, but I don't have a sense that there's, you know, insisting on a Security Council meeting before the end of the year or something. And so I think we're probably still some time away. And I think the sanctions that emerge from the international process will be quite limited. Yeah. They'll be additional to the ones that exist, but they'll be much more limited than the Congress or others are talking about, and they're not going to cripple the Iranian economy.
Yeah. Well, thanks. It feeds right into the segue. Of the five pieces in the article, in the issue, one of them is written by the former head of the Israeli National Security Council, Gior Eland. And in that article, he makes the argument that there are sort of four scenarios that might come forward in the question about will Israel attack. And that, of course, is the clock that's driving a lot of these actions and on sanctions and elsewhere. In that article, he says that if there is either an agreement with Iran that's effective, an international multilateral sanctions coalition that's effective, a multilateral sanctions coalition that will ultimately frustrate Israel because it would allow Iran to be a sort of virtual nuclear weapon state, very close to the screwdriver's turn from having nuclear weapons, would frustrate Israel, but ultimately might not provoke an Israeli attack. Or in the fourth scenario, no international coalition on sanctions and no willingness of the United States to do anything militarily. And at that point, he says, Israel takes matters into its own hands. So the segue over to Andy, then, is that Russia has been, up to this point, the sort of principal blocker behind which some would argue the Chinese have hid up to this point. There are a number of people from the embassy community, a number of embassies around Washington, around the table, that we can broaden the discussion. But let's start this discussion with Russia's perspective on the nuclear weapons issue, particularly their reaction to the research reactor agreement in October that was awfully favorable for them, and how that changes their perspective, what they might do in the coming weeks and months going forward.
Thanks, Alex, for the opportunity to join the panel today, and congratulations on a terrific issue. The set of pieces on Iran are it's really a great collection, and it's a great way to quickly really catch up on these issues. And congratulations, in particular, to Jim and Suzanne for their pieces, which I learned a lot from. Jim, I was rather wistful in reading your piece and feeling the sense of missed opportunities that we had for engagement with Iran earlier in this decade. And Suzanne, I really learned a lot from your piece about the and really the detailed history of sanctions with Iran. So thanks very much. On Russia, let me first clarify that I don't think that any when we talk about what are we hoping from Russia. I don't think that anybody seriously thinks that Russia actually has significant leverage over what Iran does. I think what we're talking about, one, is that we don't want Russians to transfer air defense systems. We don't want them to kind of open the door for further enrichment at the Bushehr facility, things like that. But most fundamentally, I think what we're talking about is what the Russians will do regarding sanctions. I'll come back to the Russian lack of leverage issue later. The first point I would make is that I see the Russian position as is fairly consistent over a number of years regarding the sanction question. I mean, there was a lot of hullabaloo this fall with the comments of Foreign Minister Lavrov, Prime Minister Putin, and then President Medvedev. And that they reflected, you know, very different views on sanctions and possibly Medvedev's fundamental change. I don't agree with that at all. I didn't see those. I don't see the comments that emerged from any of the three in the fall significantly differing from Russia's position. Russia has never categorically been against sanctions on Iran. Russia has supported several sanctions, UN rounds of sanctions on Iran. Russia has never been enthusiastic about sanctions on Iran, and the Russian game has consistently been to water down, dilute sanctions to the greatest extent possible to help mitigate potential damage to their bilateral relationship with Iran. And I see that as essentially the Russian aspiration today. Their preferred position would be status quo, in that certainly, on one hand, they really don't want to see military action in the region, which they see as destabilizing, and secondly, they really don't want to see a U.S. Western breakthrough with Iran, which would result in the erosion of their geopolitical position and their relationship with Iran. And this gets to me what is the larger. You know, where is Russia in the world? Russia, to me, is principally a status quo, aspires to be a status quo power, but in effect their power is declining. And the perception is that changes in status quo, mostly across the board, especially with Iran, possibly with the exception of some of the countries in their neighborhood, East Central Europe, the former Warsaw Pact countries, they view change as going to be bad. Okay? They will lose. Russia's interests in Iran are highly complex. At one level, yes. I take them at their word when they say they do not want to see Iran have a nuclear weapons capability. But it's also true that they certainly do not see this as an existential threat. In fact, I think, I don't know if anybody else in the world sees this as an existential threat besides Israel and the United States.
It may be a semantic
point. But what I would add to that is that in general, Russians tend to be, I think, greater believers in the power of deterrence than Americans. They've lived for a long time in close proximity to nuclear powers. They are certainly less inclined to the argument that authoritarian, totalitarian governments are more prone to irrational behavior. They heard themselves described this way in the early nuclear period in the late 1940s and early 1950s. I would point to their own experience with Mao's China, which they did view Mao as deeply irrational, and they did very seriously consider a preemptive strike on Chinese nuclear facilities. But eventually they found that they were able to live with that. And so there's this history there that they're sort of inclined to believe in the power of deterrence to a greater extent than we are, at least be less likely to buy into the argument of irrational, crazy response. I think to some extent the Russians would buy into, I think, what came to be the George W. Bush doctrine that the greatest threat is the possibility of nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorists. But I think that I know the Russians would regard Pakistan as a much greater threat in this regard than Iran. And there's a lot of history there that to suggest that maybe the Russians are actually right. Now, as Russia also in the post-Soviet period has tended to view Iran much more as a geopolitical partner. They cooperated together to resolve the civil war in Tajikistan in the early 1990s. The Iranians were never critical of the Russian wars in Chechnya. Russians have perceived Iranians as a common enemy against radical Sunni Wahhabi Islamic groups, and therefore the kinds of groups that they see as not only threatening them directly in the North Caucasus, which is, and that when you talk about the war on terrorism for Russia, that's it, but also in Central Asia. And I think you could also argue that the Russians would see their interests closer along these lines in Afghanistan. Economic interests. Obviously, the Russians have their arms sale relationship. They have nuclear, civilian nuclear relationship. They would love to be have exclusive or first rights of refusal on the development of Iranian energy resources. But I think actually when we get to the issue of energy, this is where the interests of Iran and Russia start to get much more fuzzy. Oil, sure, the oil price, higher oil price, Russians and Iranians benefit. But it's the issue of natural gas, which the Russians would view the possibility of the Iranian development of their natural gas resources and sales to European markets as a direct threat and a direct competitor. So Russia, I think, actually has benefited from and continues to benefit from Iran's status as a rogue state, quasi-rogue state, where international sanctions are against that, which helps to has an impact on the oil price to their benefit, but much more, I think more importantly, more fundamentally, gets to the gas question, because that is right at the heart of the Kremlin's power and their wheelhouse, and it's a separate discussion. I think there's a deep absence of trust in the relationship at large. I've sensed for the last several years that to some extent the Russians have been nearly as frustrated with Tehran's obstinance on the nuclear question as the United States. Despite the cross-cutting interests I described before, I think there is an element on the Russian psyche that would love to see themselves as being the mediator that would resolve the situation and help to embellish, you know, their status as a significant major player on the world stage. But the trust issue and the crux of the relationship, and there are three points in the last 7 years that really stuck out at me and led me to deeply question this. One was, first of all, the revelation of the by the Iranian dissident group in Iraq in late 2002 about the various nuclear facilities in Iran. I remember I was in Moscow, at the Carnegie Moscow Center at the time. John Bolton came early in 2003, I think January, to talk about that. And I had a distinct impression that that Russian intelligence on this was not that good, really not that good, which, you know, leads to a lot of questions about, you know, just how much do the how much is being shared between the Russians and the Iranians. The second moment that caught my attention where this came up was at Heilongjiang, the G8 meeting in 2007, when Mr. Putin pulled out of his back pocket the proposal for sharing the data from the Gabala radar station in Azerbaijan. And I remember him say, Putin said, yes, and I spoke with Ilham Aliyev in the last 24 hours, and he's supportive of the proposal, which led me to chuckle, thinking that, the Russians consult their allies kind of like we do. But the larger question was, gee, I wonder if Mr. Putin consulted Tehran about this proposal he was making to President Bush and other G8 members before. I don't think so. Nobody has been able to confirm that that's the case. And certainly, if I were in Tehran, I would not have taken that so kindly. The third point was just this fall, the revelations about the Qom facility. And how did the Russians find out about that? As far as I understand, they found out about that by reading the newspaper. Okay, so again, it gets to what are the actual intelligence resources they have and how much is actually being shared between Tehran and Moscow. And I think it just points to the level of the absence of trust. Let me say, make two quick points. One on sort of where this is with the so-called reset button in U.S.-Russia relations, efforts of the Obama administration to improve relations with Russia. And it gets to a concern of mine. There have been statements by administration officials that have clearly identified that when it comes to the reset button or the desire to improve relations with Russia, it is the Iran issue which is number one. I think the three most important issues are Iran, Afghanistan, nuclear security, and doing the START-1 replacement treaty. My concern is that if Russia is not perceived to be cooperative, if the rubber hits the road and the rubber hitting the road is the sanctions issue and the Russians are not perceived to be cooperative, that may sabotage the broader relationship. I think that there are many that view this issue as sort of a litmus test of whether Russia is with us or against us. Even absent that, if we look at Capitol Hill, if the Russians are not perceived to be with us on this, you can start assuming the START-1 replacement treaty is successfully negotiated, which I think it will be, and announced hopefully shortly. The vote on the Hill is going to be very tough. That'll make it tougher. It's going to sabotage other things like Russia's WTO accession and Jackson Vanek and civilian nuclear reaction, nuclear cooperation across the board. The domestic political environment already in Washington is not very favorable to Russia, and this would be a big blow. And also, I think understandably, the Obama administration would lose considerable interest in trying to improve and work with the Russians. It's just not that important. And this, in a way, gets to the last point somewhat obliquely. I mean, typically, Alex, as you put it, Russia's been kind of regarded as a key a key ally and a key supporter to bring international consensus and cooperation together. I'm a little more, I'm definitely more skeptical about that today than I was in past years. Yes, I think that the Chinese, Indians, and others have found it useful that the Russians have vocally taken the lead in opposing this. But as I look at the changing balance of power and I look at the depth of the Chinese interests, particularly economic interests, which are much greater in Iran than the Russian ones, frankly, I would love to see the proposition tested that the Russians went along with us, and then we see whether the Chinese actually would. I'm not as confident about that as I might have been in the past. Thanks.
Thanks, Andy. It was extremely useful. With that, I want to open this up to a discussion with the group as a whole. We've got about 25 minutes or so. If you have questions or comments you'd like to make, please just let me know. I just ask that you identify yourself by your name and the institution where you work, if you would, and then we can open this up to a broader discussion rather than just the people at the front of the table. I wonder, for starters, if Ambassador Schulte, if I might sort of ask on you to draw on you. For those of you that don't know, Ambassador Schulte was the former U.S. ambassador to the IAEA until recently. I forget, you have to remind me exactly when that was. And to draw on your own experiences and sort of perspectives on these issues to add to what has been said already.
Well, thank you. Can Iran's bomb be stopped? And my answer is probably not. Which I think forces us to think, as our panelists have been thinking about, well, what does that mean in terms of next steps and what are our objectives? And I think our objectives need to be to counter the consequences of a nuclear-armed Iran within the region, to prevent a further round of proliferation in the region or elsewhere, and also, as Ambassador Dobbins suggested, to sort of set the stage for an eventual rollback of Iran's nuclear program if and when the leadership changes. And I think this means we have to start thinking about a number of things. This is less a diplomatic challenge and more a security challenge in many ways. We need to think about how do we strengthen security relationships with countries in the region. We need to think about how do we provide assurances to the countries that are most exposed. And here I think NATO may have a role, even though NATO's consumed with Afghanistan now. And I think we may need to rethink of things like extended nuclear deterrence. I think we need to sharpen our tools to detect and disrupt proliferation in the future. And I think we really need to think about how our policy and how our sanctions, and I think you've started to do this, won't necessarily prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons now, but could help create the conditions so over time we can convince them to roll back their nuclear program, because I think that's important if we're going to be able to, if we're going to prevent proliferation elsewhere and remove that tool from their leadership. So I think I'm like the panelists. I want diplomacy to work. We shouldn't give up on it, but it's not clear to me we're going to be successful. And I think we need to figure out how do we contain the consequences.
Senator Dobbins, you mentioned we need a strategy beyond possible nuclear status of Iran. The question that I have is, what does this mean? What's the impact in the Middle East of that simple fact? It's definitely so that the American influence would decline dramatically, particularly vis-a-vis Arab states. And then you get questions like oil security and other issues. Can you discuss the impact of America's role in the Middle East if we go to that point? Thank you.
Did America's influence in Europe decline when the Soviet Union got nuclear weapons? Or do you think America's influence in Europe increased?
Well, but look at the cost. Look at the cost.
Cost of who?
Well, I mean, you had to build up the dual-track decision and all that.
That worked. That was 30
but
years
is that
later,
the same? Is the same impact then true for the Middle East? That's my real question.
I think that extended deterrence is certainly a component of the strategy, certainly with respect to Israel, and probably with respect to the Gulf states. Now, the difference with the not Saudi Arabia, but the other Gulf states is that Iran's getting nuclear weapons actually makes no difference. Iran can obliterate them without nuclear weapons. It could overrun them, in 2 days. They're so small and so weak that this additional accretion of Iranian power really doesn't change the balance between them very much. With respect to Iraq or Saudi Arabia, it's somewhat different. And so I think those are the states where a nuclear Iran would require them to consider revising their relations with Washington. And it would require Washington to consider agreeing to that. It's possible that either because Washington was unresponsive or because these countries lacked confidence in American potential guarantees, that they would instead seek to accommodate Iran to some degree. But given their antipathies toward Iran and sensitivities about encroachments on their sovereignty, it's not clear to me how far that could go or would go or what the consequences are. I mean, Iran is not seeking to invade or occupy any of these countries. It promotes its influence through ideological and covert means. So even if they were trying to accommodate Iran, and we see this. I mean, you see that. I mean, Qatar is a good example of a country that has a major American base, the headquarters of Central Command, and is very obsequious toward Iran. And so you'd probably see a good deal of that kind of behavior in which they covered their bets by both accommodating Iran to the extent possible and seeking the closest possible security guarantees and relations with the United States at the same time.
Anyone want to add?
Yeah, I think I wanted to just get in at least one note of caution about presuming failure, and it's not to suggest that, as Ambassador Schulte said, preparing for containment is important. I mean, obviously, we ought to be engaged in that if we're not already. It has to be done discreetly to avoid invoking political sensitivities or the sense that we've already ceded the battle. But there's a lot that we don't know, and I would say I suspect that's true even among those who have access to classified information about Iranian capabilities and intentions. The program, though the Iranians have pushed it very fast and very far, despite international penalties for doing so, has been subject to both technological problems and conceivably, at least if you believe the 2007 NIE, some political decision to restrain the weaponization dimension of the program. So I think that we also have to recognize that this is the inevitability of an Iranian weapon is not yet assured. Will the Iranians have the capability is a question that is really left best to experts, and I know experts in government and outside who would say they already have more capability than we would have said a few years ago we were willing to permit them to have. And so drawing those red lines is harder to do. But I do think that as we plan for some sort of Iranian nuclear Japan status, which may be likely, we should also recognize that there is a distinction between that and an actual weapons capability in Iranian Pakistan, which I hope we will never be in a situation to see.
Yeah. Just one other thing I want to add on this, and we talk about sort of regional dynamics. When people ask the question about, you know, why is a nuclear Iran so much more threatening than a nuclear North Korea? And you look at the dynamics around the region, it's not just the U.S. relations with the countries in the region surrounding the proliferating country. But if you start to get at the potential motivations for the countries around Iran, and particularly the three that everyone rattles off are Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, it's not that those countries feel that Iran necessarily will use nuclear weapons to attack them. It's that Egypt is Arab, Saudi Arabia is Sunni, and Turkey is Ottoman. And if you, or excuse me, Shia, if you define it in those terms, it's much more of a sort of prestige motivation rather than a threat motivation or actual security for what might cause the nuclear domino chains that everyone's worried about on that front. Manuel, yeah.
I'm Manuel Lafont-Rapnouy from CSIS. I just would like to make a comment on what is happening in Europe, because I'm European, as my accent is explicitly mentioned.
Just say Manuel's a visiting fellow. He's from the French diplomatic corps, French policy.
But obviously talking on my personal standing, which will lead me to one question. Basically, so the EU3 have been trying to deal with this issue for a long time now, and one of the balance that you can make of these efforts is that we've never quite managed to advance a credible two-legged approach that we've been looking for. That is, either we've been looking too soft or not seducive enough, or we've been looking too confrontational and not credibly confrontational, though less often than too soft, probably. And so the consensus now is that we have to build up on the two legs of the approach. And the feeling in Europe, as I can see it, being here, but nevertheless, is that the diplomatic situation is favorable to put more pressure, more effective pressure on the Iranian leadership, partly because of the change of policy from the U.S. with the Obama administration, and that there's a new sequence that is now opening after the first year of the Obama administration. There's been a lot of skepticism about sanctions since the very beginning, everywhere, not only in Europe, which has undermined this double approach. But with the 12th of June events, obviously, there's a change of mindset. The idea of sanction is not necessarily that under pressure the Iranian leadership will be able to make the right choice, but that the balance of power within the Iranian leadership may change. It's not... You say that there's this division between the conservatives who say that they can overcome and survive these sanctions with the following the Chinese model, and the reformists who are on a more interdependent way of seeing things. But the question is not the question is how do we have the line between these two sides move, narrowing the importance of the conservative approach, and. What happened in June is actually moving in that direction. And it is moving in that direction also in Europe, where you can see European countries more willing to take their responsibilities. And the last European Council actually said not only that it would support further sanctions from the UN Security Council, but that it would accompany further sanctions, meaning that it's a step toward autonomous measures adopted by Europe, adding to the UN sanctions. And from what I understand, the major countries that are always mentioned as being very reluctant to this kind of step, like Germany, were not among the ones that were strongly opposing this wording. There's been, for all these years that we've spent on the Iranian issue, there's been a debate growing in Europe about sanctions, but we've moved a lot from what was the situation in 2003, where obviously the debate was dominated by the Iraq model of sanctions, the big, wide, overall comprehensive embargo that is mainly targeted at punishing a regime and without any incentive for change of behavior and everything. And now it's not only that we've understood that you can also do targeted or smart sanctions, but also that sanctions have to be part of a wider strategy, as you've both said, that is part of a broader diplomatic enterprise to move forward. And so we are on that road toward sanctions and diplomacy, sanctions as not only punishing but also obstructing the Iranian actions, deterring others or the Iranian leadership to go any further, etc., etc. But I'm wondering whether the debate on sanctions is that elaborated in the American foreign policy community, especially on the political side, and whether actually what Congress is discussing right now is not, as you've alluded to, more gesticulation, posturing, than really helping to the administration to move in the right direction toward that that double approach. Thank you.
I mean, I think the discussion in the Congress is largely simplistic on this, I suspect. I don't know that there was a great deal of discussion in Congress on it.
What a surprise.
Yeah. And I think that's largely true. You know, as I suggested, we tend to focus exclusively on the nuclear issue, and we tend to focus on instruments, military, economic, or diplomacy, as if they're alternatives.
Let me just add one point, because you brought up an issue that we hadn't talked about, which was the question of the likelihood of kind of coalition of the willing sanctions on Iran, which I suspect, depending on how the Security Council debate plays out, will be part of the next steps for the administration and its strongest supporters on this, including your government. I think to the extent possible, where and how those sanctions can focus on, as I saw news articles suggest the other day, the Revolutionary Guard is the face of repression. To focus more broadly beyond the nuclear program, I think that would have a positive impact, mild but positive impact, on the impression that the international community makes to the Iranian green movement / opposition, however you want to describe it. There are a lot of ways that we can have a very, I think, powerful impact. And I think back to 2006 or 2007, it was the Iranians sent Saidi Mortazavi, the notorious then Tehran prosecutor, to the inaugural session of the Human Rights Council. This was someone whose record on human rights is beyond horror. And the idea that he was welcomed in Europe on protocol basis is really reprehensible. And so I think that's an opportunity that the administration should pick up, recognizing that that travel bans on notorious human rights abusers aren't likely to change the way the Iranians treat their opposition protesters, but that it can at least make a statement that the international community recognizes that there's something beyond the nuclear issue that we have in terms of our differences with Iran.
Got one question over here. The only thing I'd add, Manuel, is actually this is to take a line out of Ambassador Dobbins' piece, is the line is that engagement does not always yield accommodation, but it does yield information. When you talk about sort of the level of detail about how and to what extent sanctions can move Iranian politics, the fact that we haven't had political relations with Iran for going on 30 years now very much limits the ability of the U.S. foreign policy elite, much less the broader political base in the Congress and elsewhere, to think about how you actually get involved in Iranian politics, because we have so little understanding. I mean, most countries are sort of, I think, bewildered by the opaqueness of the structure, but it's even more...
As far as I understand... countries that have embassies in Iran also have problems.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a step up from where we're at right now, and I'll tell you that.
Houman Saysan, Voice of America. Ambassador Dobbins, you talked about the Iranian cooperation after the fall of Taliban. How much do you contribute that to the kind of psychological atmosphere they were feeling like they were threatened by the U.S. After the invasion of Afghanistan? And if that the answer is yes, that's why they turned to a good diplomats. Is that what kind of lesson we can learn from that?
Well, Iranians made two substantial overtures of cooperation with the United States, one in late 2001, early 2002, and then the second one in the spring of 2003. So in the immediate aftermath, first of the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, and then secondly in the invasion of Iraq, and their motivations were pretty clear. They were grateful and they were fearful. They were grateful that we just knocked off their two principal enemies, and they were fearful that they were next. And so this combination of gratitude and anxiety undoubtedly contributed to their policies. Now, it was the Khatami government. They had been considering and to some degree open to improve relations even before those events, but those events certainly pushed them over the threshold. So I think it was a coincidence of Iranian and U.S. interests, on the one hand, that we'd just done something that they liked, and they saw that their interest in ours, as far as they were concerned with Afghanistan and Iraq, were quite coincident. For instance, they wanted democratic Iraqs and democratic Afghanistans in the sense of countries that would actually be more responsive to, in the case of Iraq, for instance, the Shia majority. So if anti-terrorism meant anti-Al-Qaeda, they were all for it. So I don't think this means we ought to find another country to invade. I'm not sure what countries border on Iran that are left. Pakistan, maybe? That might do it. But
Turkmenistan. Let's get the gas.
Yes. But short of that, I don't think we can quite replicate the circumstances that led to those overtures, which is why it may be a while before we get another one.
Andy, you got something?
Yeah, I just add that the Iranian decision to work with us in Afghanistan, in the international coalition, that, you know, I think that was principally driven, as Jim was saying, by Iran's perceptions that their interests, to a great extent, coincided with ours.
And it wasn't that they joined our coalition.
Right.
We joined their coalition.
That's
their coalition consisted of India, Russia,
exactly,
Iran, and the Northern Alliance, and
exactly,
we joined their coalition.
Exactly. I'm much closer to the Russian side of this, but the Russians have been warning us about this for several years. The Russians had approached the Clinton administration in 1999 about taking out Al-Qaeda camps and training centers in Afghanistan because of they saw it as a threat and what they were doing in Central Asia. But it was really striking when reading your piece, Jim, that, you know, after they do work with us on this and play an important role, not as important as the Russians, but not insignificant, how are they rewarded? Well, they're lumped into the axis of evil. I mean, that just struck me rereading that is sort of amazing. I mean, I've always been struck that there was a real missed opportunity with to develop the relationship with the Russians if we'd not just been distracted and moved over to Iraq, because there was a closer coincidence of our interests in Afghanistan. That's where they most closely align. But, you know, even there, there's a lot of conflict with the Russians. I can go into it later. To say that in a study, actually we just had this report released today, on the Northern Distribution Network in Afghanistan. For the research in that, I was in Tashkent in late July, talking with very high-level Uzbek government officials, and who essentially made the argument that when it comes to Afghanistan, the Iranians are more reliable allies for you than the Russians, and their interests are more aligned with yours.
Got time for one last question with Ferial over here.
Hi, I'm Ferial Saeed. I'm a Foreign Service officer on detail to the National Defense University, but of course I'm just representing myself here. I have two questions. First of all, why do you think they rejected the Geneva deal? Some have suggested it's because the opposition wanted to deny Ahmadinejad any kind of political victory. And secondly, how will we get the Iranians back to the table once we have crippling sanctions in place, given the fact that the leadership does feel politically vulnerable at this point?
Want to start?
You know, what happened in the month of October is a bit of a mystery, I think, to everyone. The prevailing conventional wisdom explanation has been that the Iranians recognized at the most senior leadership levels, after some commitment had been made at the negotiating level, that this was, in fact, a more existential issue. It was getting to the heart of what they had invested so much money and energy and diplomatic cost into over the past 25 years, and that they had given it up too cheaply and too easily, and therefore they pedaled back, in part because it became politically contentious. I think we simply don't know. What there does seem to be evidence of is that the Iranian foreign policy bureaucracy, as we know it, including the elite decision-making levels, is not functioning at its most coherent level since June. There have been now the departure of two of the members of the nuclear negotiating team appointed by Ahmadinejad, and there have been some suggestions that the Supreme National Security Council is not meeting or had went lengthy periods without meeting. You know, obviously, Iranian decision-making doesn't all happen in the halls of formal institutions, but to the extent that there has been such a cleavage within the elite that even longtime members of the fold are no longer welcome or no longer part of the sort of council of decision-makers, I think it's very clear that you don't have the coherence that you had pre-June, and I think everyone recognizes that wasn't always terribly coherent. So we have just an organizational functional problem, I think, at this point, as well as potentially an ideological problem. In terms of bringing the Iranians back to the negotiating table with sanctions, you know, you bring up an important point, which is that Khamenei and those around him believe that the best defense is a good offense, and when they feel threatened, they're less likely to conciliate than they are to strike back. And that is one of the difficulties with using pressure in coordination with incentives to bring Iran to the table. But clearly, incentive alone is not going to do it at this point. So we have really no alternative but to consider how to maximize pressure and enticement. I would say that the best way to bring Iran is to avoid those measures that appear to be targeting the sort of capacity of the country to function, and there I mean specifically the refined petroleum imports, and looking more toward measures that are targeted toward specific constituencies that conceivably have some influence over the nuclear policy. Obviously, that's the Revolutionary Guard and the economic organizations around it, and those can be more narrowly targeted. And they also have direct costs. I think that's been the real success story of what the Treasury Department has done, is that it has imposed real costs on actual current business. And those businessmen go back and have to deal with the costs that they've been that are suddenly now making their business more difficult, more expensive, more time-consuming, and more inconvenient. So to the extent that we can do that, as opposed to sort of leveling off segments of the Iranian economy that are no longer viable for different parts of the international community, I think that the grandiose schemes are less valuable than these very small-bore, micro-targeted sanctions that also have the benefit of being easier to rescind if and when we have reason to do so.
Jim, final word?
Well, I think the one thing I fault President Obama on was a statement he made which suggested that he was going to abandon, that at some point he would have to abandon engagement and turn to sanctions. And I think that suggests a binary relationship between the two, which is not accurate and necessary. So I don't think that at any stage we should abandon engagement, even as we apply additional sanctions. Now, the Iranians may walk away from the table, but I don't think we should walk away from the table. We should be quite happy to schedule an additional meeting, continue to discuss, and so we should not create any more new thresholds for ourselves.
I mean, the final word I'd say on that is, especially if you want to talk about getting a multilateral coalition that involves the Chinese and others, the last thing you want to do is say once we start doing sanctions, the negotiations are out as foreclosed. I mean, they're, in their mind, it's very much a means to an end, which is to get a negotiated agreement at the end of the table. So that coalition is more likely to be stronger if we avoid that binary choice, as the panelists have said. With that, I want to close the formal roundtable session of this. As for those of you that you have the two articles that we discussed here, the rest of the issue is available both online at www.twq.com. It is also available at Borders. If it's not there now, it will be over the weekend if the snow doesn't keep everybody buried up for the weekend. As I mentioned at the beginning, the lunch is going to be served out in the atrium. You are welcome to come back in here. We have this room until 1:30 or so and to continue more of an informal discussion among yourselves. Otherwise, in the meantime, if you'd please help me formally thank both Andy and especially Suzanne and Jim for coming and sharing their views with us today.